Okay, so today we're going deep on something that's, well, it's kind of a legal landmine, you know, something that can really trip you up if you're not careful, especially if you're thinking about a career in law.
Definitely. I mean, procedure can be tricky, right? Like knowing when and where to bring your claims can make or break your case.
Absolutely. And the case we're looking at today for REVE Rate Consulting Services, it's a perfect example of that. It really highlights the importance of understanding these procedural rules, especially when you're dealing with employment law cases that might overlap with other types of claims.
Yeah, you've got these tricky intersections between federal and state law, different types of claims, and it can get really messy if you don't have a clear strategy from the start.
Right. So what we're going to try to do today is unpack this case, break down the court's reasoning, and really distill some practical takeaways for our listeners so you guys can avoid these pitfalls, you know, in your future legal careers.
Sounds good. I think it'll be helpful for anyone, even just interested in law, to see how these procedural rules play out in a real-world scenario.
For sure. Okay, so let's just jump right in. This case revolves around what's called a compulsory counterclaim rule,
Right.
specifically in Alabama. Have you ever come across this rule before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It comes up a lot, especially when you have, like we said, these situations where a dispute could potentially be litigated in multiple courts, maybe state and federal.
Okay, so for our listeners who might be new to this, can you just give us a quick rundown of what this rule basically says?
Sure. So basically, the compulsory counterclaim rule says that if someone sues you and you have a claim against them that arises from the same basic set of facts or events as their claim, and your claim is ready to go, legally speaking, at the time you file your response to their lawsuit, then you have to bring that claim as a counterclaim in that same lawsuit. You can't save it for later and file a separate lawsuit.
Got it. So it's kind of like you have to put all your cards on the table right away. If you don't, you might lose the chance to play those cards later on.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's all about efficiency, too. You know, courts don't want to deal with multiple lawsuits about the same basic dispute. It just wastes everyone's time and resources.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back to Ferrari. Can you set the scene for us? What were the basic facts of the case?
Okay, so we had Miss Ferrari. She worked for this company, E-Rate Consulting Services, for a very short time, only 3 weeks back in the summer of 2007.
Wow, that's a short stint.
Yeah, it was. And then in January 2008, E-Rate and its owner, a guy named Swatter, they actually sued Ferrari in Alabama State Court.
Interesting. So she worked there for 3 weeks and then they sued her. What was that all about?
Well, their claims weren't actually about her work performance or anything like that. They were about what she allegedly did after she left the company. Things like making threats, demanding excessive compensation, and even filing what they claimed was a totally bogus criminal harassment complaint against them.
Oh, wow. So it got pretty heated.
It sounds like it, yeah. And they were alleging things like libel, slander, false light, and interference with their business relationship. So serious stuff.
Okay, so we have this state court lawsuit going on. What did Mr. Ferrari do in response?
Well, just a couple of days before E-Rate and Slaughter filed that lawsuit, Ferrari actually filed a discrimination charge with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Right, the EEOC, they handle claims of workplace discrimination, right?
Exactly. So she files this EEOC charge. Then, about a month later, she files her answer to the state court lawsuit, but she doesn't include any counterclaims against E-Rate or Slaughter in that answer.
Interesting. So she's pursuing this discrimination claim through the EEOC, but she's not bringing those claims in the state court case yet. Why not?
Well, that's where the timing and the specific nature of the claims get really important, and it all goes back to that compulsory counterclaim rule we were talking about.
Okay, so keep walking us through this timeline. What happens next?
So months go by, and then in November 2008, Ferrari gets her right to sue letter from the EEOC.
Right, you need that letter before you can file a lawsuit for discrimination in federal court, correct?
Exactly. It's a key procedural step. So she gets that letter, and then in January 2009, she files her own lawsuit in federal court against E-Rate and Slaughter. And in this lawsuit, she alleges sexual harassment, constructive termination, and retaliation under Title VII, all stemming from her brief employment with them.
Okay, so now she's bringing those discrimination claims. And these claims are based on things that allegedly happened during her 3 weeks of employment, right?
Right. And she also throws in some state law claims for things like assault, battery, and outrage, again, based on the same alleged incidents of sexual harassment and unwanted physical contact during that time.
So we have these two lawsuits going on. The state court case initiated by the employer focused on Ferrari's post-employment actions, and then Ferrari's federal court case focused on what she claims happened during her employment.
Exactly. And that sets up the central question the court had to grapple with. Why were some of her claims allowed to proceed in federal court while others were dismissed as compulsory counterclaims that should have been raised in that earlier state court case?
Okay, so that takes us back to the compulsory counterclaim rule. Can we break down how the court applied that rule in this case?
Sure. So remember we talked about the two key elements of the rule. First, the counterclaim has to arise out of the same transaction or occurrence as the original claim. Courts use this logical relationship test to figure that out.
Right. Basically, are the claims so related that it makes sense to deal with them all together in one lawsuit?
Yeah, that's the gist of it. And in Ferrari, the court actually found that both her Title VII claims and her state law claims did have this logical relationship to the claims in the state court lawsuit. They saw both sets of claims as stemming from that same short period of employment and the events immediately following it.
Okay, so the court saw a connection there. But if all of Ferrari's claims were logically related to the state lawsuit, why didn't she have to bring all of them as counterclaims in that case? Why were some of them allowed to go forward in federal court?
That's where the second element of the rule comes into play. The counterclaim has to be mature at the time you file your answer to the initial lawsuit. And this is where things get a little tricky, especially when you're dealing with claims like Title VII claims that involve an administrative process before you can even file a lawsuit.
Okay, so walk us through that. How did the maturity issue affect Ferrari's Title VII claims?
So remember that Ferrari filed her answer to the state court lawsuit in February 2008. But she didn't receive her right to sue letter from the EEOC until November 2008. And the court was very clear that a Title VII claim is not mature until you have that right to sue letter in hand.
Right, it's like a permission slip. Yeah. You can't go to federal court with your Title VII claim until the EEOC gives you the okay.
Exactly. So the court said, look, in February 2008, when Ferrari filed her answer in the state court case, she couldn't have brought her Title VII claims even if she wanted to. They weren't ripe yet. She hadn't fulfilled that crucial prerequisite of getting the right to sue letter.
So because of that timing issue, the court said she didn't have to bring those Title VII claims as counterclaims in the state court case.
That's right. They weren't compulsory counterclaims because they weren't mature at the time she filed her answer. And that's why she was allowed to go ahead and file her separate federal lawsuit later on once she had that right to sue letter.
Okay, that makes sense. So what about her other claims, the state law claims for assault, battery, and outrage? The court didn't let her proceed with those in federal court, right?
Right. Those claims were treated differently. The court said, yeah, those claims are also logically related to the state court case, but they were mature back in February 2008 when Ferrari filed her answer. There's no administrative process you have to go through for those types of claims.
So if something like an assault or battery happens, your claim arises immediately. You don't have to wait for permission from an agency to sue.
Exactly. So the court said those state law claims were mature and they were related to the claims in the state court case. So she should have brought them as counterclaims back then. She didn't. And because of that, she was barred from bringing them up later in a separate lawsuit.
Wow. So that's a tough lesson. It really shows how important it is to be aware of this rule and to think strategically about all potential claims from the very beginning of a case.
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at the big picture. What are all the possible claims, both state and federal? When do they become mature? Where can they be brought? You don't want to inadvertently give up any potential claims by not raising them at the right time and in the right place.
Absolutely. And for our listeners out there, especially those considering a legal career, what are some key takeaways from this case? What should they keep in mind as they're navigating these potentially tricky procedural waters?
I think the biggest takeaway is to be comprehensive in your initial assessment of any legal situation. Don't just focus on what the other side is alleging. Think about all possible claims your client might have, even claims that might seem tangential or that could be brought in a different court system.
Right. So even if you're on the defense, you need to be thinking offensively too. What claims could we potentially bring against the other side?
Exactly. And you need to be meticulous about deadlines and procedural requirements. The Ferrari case really highlights how important it is to know when a claim becomes mature, especially when you're dealing with things like the EEOC process, where you have specific steps you have to take before you can file a lawsuit.
Right. Missing a deadline or failing to follow a procedural rule can have serious consequences. You could lose your right to bring a claim altogether.
Absolutely. And this case also shows how important it is to be aware of the potential interplay between state and federal law. You might have a situation where state law claims are mature and need to be brought immediately, while federal claims might not be ripe yet because of an administrative process.
So you might have to be juggling different timelines and strategies.
Definitely. And that can get very complex. So having a solid understanding of these procedural rules and how they interact is essential.
So just to recap, the Ferrari case shows us that. One, you have to be aware of the compulsory counterclaim rule and understand the two key elements, the logical relationship test and the maturity requirement. Two, you need to think broadly about all potential claims from the outset of any litigation. And three, you have to be really diligent about cracking deadlines and procedural prerequisites, especially when you're dealing with both state and federal claims.
Yeah, those are all great points. And I think this case also highlights the tension that sometimes exists between judicial efficiency, trying to resolve all related disputes in a single lawsuit, ensuring that all parties have a fair opportunity to present their claims.
Right. The court has to balance those competing interests.
Exactly. And sometimes, like in Ferrari, you end up with a split outcome. Some claims are allowed to proceed, while others are barred because of procedural rules.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a question to ponder. How do you think these principles of claim preclusion, the idea that you can't relitigate a claim that's already been decided and the compulsory counterclaim rule, how do you think these principles might influence litigation strategy in other contexts beyond just employment law?
That's a great question. And I think it really gets at the heart of legal strategy. You have to think about what claims are available, when they can be brought, and where they should be brought. And you have to be mindful of the potential consequences of not raising a claim at the right time and in the right place.
It's a lot to consider.
It is, but that's what makes it so interesting, right?
Absolutely. Thanks for breaking all this down for us.
My pleasure. It was a great discussion.
And for our listeners, thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll be back next time with another fascinating case to explore.